The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Our news panel this weekend is Ursula Savage, political commentator, Paul Reid, chair of the Citizens Assembly on Drug Use and former HSE chief, and Craig Hughes, political editor with the Irish Daily Mail and Mail on Sunday. Guys, you're all very welcome.
Morning.
Thank you.
Morning. That was very muted. Where we will start is last night was the Trump rally in Pennsylvania, and it was seen as an attempt to reset the Trump campaign after the changes from Biden to Harris and what some campaign advisors in the Trump campaign are calling a honeymoon for Harris, what others are seeing as a fundamental shift in the momentum of the US election. But Donald Trump took to the stage in Pennsylvania last night, and to some extent, he played the hits. He touched off issues to do with his opponent. He touched off some issues to do with policy, and he tried to find as many areas where there was a potential wedge that he could drive. One of those being the issue of support for Israel.
And I'll tell you this, any Jewish person that votes for her or a Democrat has to go out and have their head examined. Because if you see what's happening with Israel and Jewish people right now, there has never been a more dangerous time since the Holocaust. If you happen to be Jewish in America, there's never been anything like it.
Now, whatever your view of his take on that issue, it is undoubtedly a significant electoral issue. He did wander slightly further off the reservation, though, including giving his analysis of climate change.
The oceans will rise 1/8 of an inch over the next 400 years. But they don't talk about a madman that's building nuclear missiles right now. That they don't ever mention it, but they talk about an ocean that's rising, which will give you slightly more beachfront property if it happens.
So we touched off climate denial, and we then he talked about the impact on specific states. Now, what's slightly interesting about this clip is it is worth remembering that this particular rally last night was in Pennsylvania.
A guy's waiting with his family for 3.5-4 days. They have a tent, and the tent is set up. They have hundreds of them, and they wait. And then I walk in, speak for 15 minutes and leave. I don't know. Somehow, would that be okay, North Carolina? I don't think so, right?
I think the Pennsylvania crowd slightly baffled by being asked if it would be OK for them in North Carolina. And where it finished up, or rather where a lot of it focused, was on his new opponent. There was a lot of resentment evident that Joe Biden had dropped out of the race. Trump saying that he had spent $100 million fighting Biden only for him to quit or be shoved out. But he feels that he is well placed against his new opponent because he is prettier than her.
But I say that I am much better looking than her. I think I'm much better. Much better. I'm a better looking person than Kamala. No, I couldn't believe it. She said, you know, I had never heard that one. They said, no, her biggest advantage is that she's a beautiful woman. I'm going, huh. I never thought of that.
All right, Craig, you dedicate your life to political analysis. Sort that one out for us.
Yeah, I mean, every week it just seems to get more and more insane despite former President Trump saying that his opponent is the lunatic. I guess the interesting thing, you know, being in Pennsylvania, I mean, that was a state that he managed to win by just 40,000 votes when he became president. Biden flipped around to 80,000 votes in 2020. It's a key state. We all know the US elections come down to trying to sway the middle ground in a very small number of states. I noticed again he went with this, you know, communist line. This is a real line that his camp are trying to push. I don't know, is it going to stick? And I guess it shows a bit of desperation. Donald Trump had been so set up and raring to go with all his attack lines on Joe Biden, which had now just been nullified. So it's back to the drawing board there. And I guess for me, and I guess other political anoraks, it'll be all eyes on later this month when they go head to head for the first debate. And I guess the interesting thing to know about that is Kamala Harris doesn't like doing debates. She doesn't like talking to the media, you know, which has to be badgered to a press conference. So it'll be interesting to see how she can adapt on her feet to the outrageous things and unpredictable lines that come out of Donald Trump's mouth.
The one thing I'm trying to get my head around is he struggling slightly in that every previous opponent that he's had has been in some way a long established incumbent politician. So there is a long record, there's a public profile, and he was seen as the fresh and unencumbered non-politician. Whereas the roles are now reversed. But Kamala Harris, despite having had a long career, hasn't been, she isn't a Hillary Clinton, she isn't a Joe Biden, she isn't that kind of long experienced public profile politician. So are the roles reversed? Is that what he's struggling with?
Slightly, but I think what he can also point as well, which he pointed to last night, where he can say to her, well, you know, any policy platform she comes up with, he'll say, well, why didn't you do this while you're in office? Which I think is, you know, is naturally a fair point as well. But I just think when you go back to his attacks on Joe Biden about competency and you know, not being an old man, that's what he's become. And you just go back to that clip you just played there. That'll be one attack line that the Democrats are now going to be able to leverage.
Ursula, on this topic, there was a similar reaction, I think, back in 2016. There was a sort of sense, oh, gotcha, that's daft and that'll never last. Why would this be any different? If this is playing the hits, do the hits not still find an audience?
I think the hits are going to find a smaller audience, but they definitely will still resonate with some people. But what I thought when I was watching the coverage and reading about the coverage of that in Pennsylvania yesterday is it's not going to do much for Trump trying to shake off this new label that the Democrats have given him of being weird. And he definitely always a bit weird and, you know, talking about the coup against Biden and calling her a lunatic and talking about her laugh. And it's not really helpful talking about how he's prettier than her. And, you know, it was very, very strange. And I think what's different about this time round in 2016 is that the Democrats are laughing at them. And not just the Democrats, but we saw Trump in that interview with the journalist organisation a couple of weeks ago where the audience sat and laughed at the things that he was saying. That's a bit different. People laughed going, oh, it'll never matter. But now people are taking him less seriously. And there's a lot of new voters now compared to what was happening in 2016. This TikTok generation are now becoming voters and they seem to really like Kamala Harris. They like that she laughs and that she's silly and that she talked about, you know, you think you fell out of a coconut tree. That resonates well with them and they think, oh, right, okay, she has a bit of personality. They might, you know, this election definitely hasn't gotten into the policy aspects of any debates yet. And you're absolutely right when you say she doesn't like really debating things and getting into the weeds of things. She really has shied away from the media. But so far, so good. So you said at the start, is this a complete overhaul of the campaign or is this a honeymoon period? I think it's both right now. But I think even when that honeymoon period does wear off, as it inevitably will, I still think that she's going to be able to kind of bring across enough of that personality and all to make him look more foolish because she's not trying to debate him where he is. She's just sort of saying, oh, come on now, really, are you serious? And I think now people know enough about Trump to kind of maybe take that a bit more seriously.
Is there a bit of method in his madness, though, Paul? Because he used to do this thing of talking about dishwashers and how long dishwashers take, and everybody said, well, that's daft. But it went to a nanny state interventionism that a certain part of his electorate hated. Likewise, the thing about the climate change denial, there is a certain cohort of his electorate who believe that if you vote Democrat, you will get limited on your 6-litre V8 truck, you won't be able to afford gas to put in your boat, you'll be limited on all of those kind of things that go with the climate change agenda. Likewise, the stuff about the Israel. It may sound horrendously extreme, but it does appeal to a cohort.
It's interesting, I was listening to Ursula saying that when it gets into the policy issues, but I don't ever think the US debates get into policy issues in any great extent. I mean, it really is so polarised. I'm somewhat connected to it because I have a son living in the States for 13 years, working there, and two grandchildren. And anytime I visit them, I'm going over in 2 weeks again, just the complete polarisation of the media, the coverage of it, the campaigning, the advertising. You know, you get state officials on who are publicly appointed, like a sheriff in a state or a town, you know, coming out why you must vote for Trump or maybe why you must vote for Kamala Harris. So it really is polarised. Thankfully, well, seemingly.
What's the sense that you get in terms of momentum, though? Because that polarisation has been there for some time. I mean, it started with the sort of the Tea Party shift in the Republican Party. But back in 2015, 2016, there was a huge wave of pro-Trump support evident everywhere. Is it the same now?
I think it has shifted. I mean, if you look at where I visit would be Austin, Texas. Austin is, you know, Austin is a Democrat. Texas is completely Republican. So, but even within, you know, you can see some challenging going on within Democrats as well about what's their policy issues. I mean, big issues that impact on people's lives. But I think when it gets to the political debate, particularly at a presidential level, you very rarely see it. But look, it is the battle of the Rust Belt states. you know, and that's what's on. And they're the ones that swing it. They swung it in 2016. They swung it in 2020, back to Biden. So this is the debate where it's going to happen. But I'm not quite sure it will be on policy issues. You know,
well, it's funny though. A text saying, Anton, how does anybody with a modicum of intelligence vote for Trump? Do they have any brain cells? I would have thought if you are a pro-life Christian, that is a very sensible choice. Trump is the one who is most likely to deliver the policies that you want. If you are a low-tax rich capitalist, Trump is a very good choice to go with. If you are a laissez-faire, don't interfere with me, climate change denier, Trump is the one to go. There's a lot of people who would benefit very clearly from Trump policy.
Yeah, but there's also the other thing. I remember going back to the Donald Trump's first presidential campaign, and people were being told, you know, okay, well, you know, either vote for Hillary Clinton or you're stupid. And it kind of pushed people. The only other kind of option was then Donald Trump. So I think you have to be careful as well with the options you put forward. I think the Republicans struggled to find new candidates coming through in this convention, which has really hampered them. I think what perhaps is another banana skin going to be tread this campaign is his selection of J.D. Vance as his vice presidential candidate. Most notably because the New York Times had a great piece on emails he'd sent to former colleagues where he disparaged in great detail Donald Trump. So when you have your own vice presidential candidate saying that you are repugnant and, you know, and not an all-round great guy, it's going to be difficult to sell your message to the public.
Although there again, this is another one of those where logic falls out the window when you look back at precedent, because Ted Cruz, the same thing. Ted Cruz declared that Donald Trump was an inveterate pathological liar. Donald Trump declared that Ted Cruz's father had attempted to assassinate JFK and that his wife was ugly. And the two of them happily got into bed together and campaigned.
Yeah, I know. The mind boggles when he continues to look at US politics, all right.
We will return to this. Alistair Campbell is going to be with us just out of 11 o'clock. He's on waiting to get a flight out to Chicago. He's going to be at the Democratic Convention. So he's been fairly close to it. And I think he's been talking to Anthony Scaramucci, among others, on the podcast. So we'll get his view as to what it looks like for Democrat and Republican politics across the water over the coming weeks and then the coming months as we come into the election. That's just after 11. Before that, lots more at home. And there's an interesting story on the front page of the Sunday Times, Ursula. This is Drew Harris raising the level of terror threat after an increase in far-right plots to kill. This is not something that is done lightly, it seems.
No, it's not. And to do this, you know, they take into a lot of things into consideration, not just the intelligence that they're gathering, but also any political, economic or political kind of consequences that could result from raising this threat level. So it is a big decision and it is very significant, but it's also unfortunately not very surprising considering the direction of travel that we're seeing over the past weeks and months, really, particularly in terms of what's happening on social media and the threats that are being made against politicians and the threats and the protests that we're seeing at politicians' homes. Simon Harris, Taoiseach in particular. So it's very significant to see this here, but also what needs to be seen now following this is like, well, how do we get ourselves out of this situation and what steps are going to be taken in order to crack down on this kind of social media bubble that's happening, that's kind of drawn people into this way of kind of taking on more extremist views? How is it going to be kind of changed so that things can be monitored ahead of time? And also, how are those people who are engaged in these things, how are they going to be punished in a way that's going to be a deterrent to other people? We've seen in the couple of people covered in the papers this morning as well, they're saying that, you know, although it hasn't been seen a major attack on an Irish politician yet, we have seen that happen in other places. And it is getting more common, unfortunately, and it is something that really, really needs to be addressed, because as much as there's been a lot of near misses or hoaxes or threats, in 2016, the MP Joe Cox was killed 2 weeks before the Brexit referendum.
John Mooney, who writes the piece, can get that serious. He says, the intelligence services have already compromised plans to kill politicians and thwarted countless arson attacks on planned refugee accommodation centres. Mm-hmm. Gardaí have even monitored extremists discussing plans to assassinate Leo Varadkar.
And that's terrifying, and it should be terrifying, and not only for where we are and for the personal safety of those people that are involved in these very important roles, but what does that mean for anybody who would think of going into a political life down the line? Why would anybody want to get involved in political life or in public life? Or why would anybody want to get engaged in public service down the line if this is the sort of treatment that's going to await them? And if we're hearing in other places as well that, you know, the Garda are under-resourced. Encryption and these technologies that are being used by these far-right extremists is developing far quicker than the Garda resources are able to keep up with it in order to stay on top of things. Until they get out ahead of this, or until they're able to match this, the threat is, you know, not just the physical threat to the safety of people, which is paramount, but also the threat to the way that the structures will operate and the people that will be attracted to take on those roles. It's a very, very pressing issue, very, very important that is dealt with and dealt with significantly.
And again, what John Mooney is saying is the Garda Commissioner has increased the threat level posed by violent political extremists from moderate to substantial, meaning that an attack is likely following an upsurge in threats to kill members of government and opposition parties by far-right extremists. And Paul Reid, when I was saying the thing about it's not done lightly, his piece says that any change in this has economic consequences, it has political consequences, it has a requirement on government then to provide extra security for politicians. That thing of it's likely that we are going to see a politician attacked seems extraordinary.
I was reminded this morning reading John Mooney's article in Sunday Times of if you think about the unthinkable happening, and Ursula referenced Joe Cox in the UK, but I often think back to Veronica Guerin, you know, a crime journalist in 1996, when she was murdered. That was a complete earthquake for the Irish system and all the changes that had to happen after that. So if you think of the unthinkable happening of a politician or a public figure being attacked seriously or, God forbid, being killed. And I think something happened during COVID, you know, where, I don't know, aggression got stronger. People were more up to be publicly challenged, which is fine. Even people in public roles like myself, you know, became subject to threats at different times. And
did you?
It was, well, I often say, look, I can recall about 2000 really nice experiences where people come up to you and want to thank the health service and want to thank the staff. And I can think of two or three that were quite threatening during that period. And, you know, not pleasant for me, not pleasant for my family. So, you know, it's public.
But, sorry, but does that mean actual you were on the receiving end of threats?
Certainly very threatening experiences, you know, where people come up to you, you know, and in a service station or wherever, and make threats to you, etc., or outside my family home. So I say that not on a personal level. I say it just to make the point, you know, for public and political figures, it's a society that we respect and we value community, probably more so than other societies. And we value our role in the community and we value our public roles in the community. And when that's threatened, society is threatened and it needs to be taken serious. And the Garda Commissioner is obviously quite right in taking it serious and making the formal recommendations that go with that. As you say, whatever the economic consequences go, funding, investment consequences go, but it needs to be treated seriously. And look, I think we're lucky in Ireland to the extent that our political system is local. It is based in the community. We want to respect it. We want to evaluate it. But it would be concerning.
But if you look, I mean, during the week what we saw with Father Paul Murphy, the army chaplain who was attacked, I mean, that is, it appears to be to do with the rise in extremism, albeit to do with issues overseas. It's not a hard extrapolation to figure if you have people who are angry enough to be setting fire to refugee centres, all you need is one person to take that to extreme and you get somebody badly hurt.
Yeah, and in fairness to the Garda Síochána, it's a very difficult one to protect when somebody goes up to an army barracks and attacks somebody going into it. A chaplain, Father Paul Murphy, our thoughts obviously with him today. So it is difficult for the guards to put security around as well.
To that thing as to whether or not it's being taken seriously, we spoke to Noreen O'Sullivan, the former Garda Commissioner, who of course then went to work as head of security in the UN, and she had led the task force on political safety. She spoke to us in May and to some extent predicted what we're now seeing from Drew Harris by talking about how significantly she took the risk and also her concerns about whether or not it was being taken seriously by the system.
It is going to escalate, is what I want to say. But I think that's where the responsibility comes in. We have made recommendations in the report which go much beyond the structures that we're just talking about. Everybody has a responsibility here. But what is lacking is strong coordination and the energy and the commitment that's needed to drive that cross-agency collaboration.
Craig Hughes, you're among the political system all the time. Is it something that politicians, do you think, take seriously? Is there a sense of concern that something, as Drew Harris is suggesting, is likely to happen?
Yes, it's a serious matter of concern, particularly for female politicians. But I mean, even journalists coming in at Leinster House, I've been threatened outside Leinster House on several occasions. I know several other of my colleagues have as well. And there was...
Now, is that some idiot roaring at you, or is that something that causes you to go home and think that was frightening?
I reported one incident to the Gardaí just to have it noted in case the same individual ever done it again. I mean, you know, I'm 6 foot man in my early 30s, you know, I'm not the easiest to target for someone. But, you know, when someone is standing there saying that they're going to strangle you, you know, it's worth noting. And I guess...
And the reasoning being what? Your mainstream media, is that what
yes,
it is?
Yeah, yeah. No, and they'd say to you, oh, you know, your mainstream media, blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, well, who do I write for? And they wouldn't know. And what have I written? Oh, they don't know. So it goes back to COVID when there was this, I guess, poisoning of social discourse with some people that led them to conspiracy theories, because in a world of uncertainty, this provided some sort of certainty. And I guess that contagion has grown now. And you see some of the people who are involved in some of the online discourse then promoting COVID conspiracies that are still active now. They've gone further down the rabbit hole. And I guess there was one line in John Mooney's piece that really struck my eye about one of the concerning things was, if people who are putting their own name to these threats publicly, like they're that far down that they don't even want to conceal it, where they're making public threats against politicians under their own name. And I guess that's the concerning thing, where it's, you know, in their mind, they feel fully justified in what they're doing. And I guess I was relieved in one sense with the, I mean, I still don't say relieved, there were some very negative incidents during the local European elections. I had feared it would be worse. I think, you know, as we look towards this general election, you know, likely to be end of October, start of November, I think that's a different, it's a kind of a different election that kind of people are much more engaged in. And I think if you're a politician, you won't be looking forward to going down some streets in kind of approaching dark winter nights. And I think security is something that every politician has really started to think about seriously in their day-to-day lives.
Which is difficult in our system. I mean, if you look across the water and you see Donald Trump, as a former president, be within inches of being murdered at a campaign rally, we have a much more open, connected, unsecure political system.
Yeah, and it's one thing for if you're the Taoiseach or any member of cabinet who is private security, but what if you're, you know, an opposition politician or just a backbench D going to an event in your community? There isn't that level of protection there, and for a security perspective, it's not something that you'd want to be relying on.
53106 if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106 if you want on WhatsApp. There is an extended interview with Stephen Donnelly, deeply critical by proxy of Paul Reid, because he says that the HSE never managed to get a culture of productivity, and that is what he is in the process of trying to tackle. We'll get analysis on that after this break. Now, before the break, I slightly facetiously suggested that Stephen Donnelly, the Health Minister, was critical by proxy of Paul Reid because he said that there was no culture of productivity within the HSE, which, of course, Paul Reid ran for quite some time. What do you make of this, that the HSE is innately and intrinsically unproductive?
I always say it was all fine when I left. I actually think it's a really good piece by Daniel Murray, his interview with the Minister, Stephen Donnelly. I think there's a few good pieces in it that the Minister references that he has implemented from a policy perspective. The new consultants contract, which is extended cover. Even recently this week, extending the role of the pharmacy in terms of what they can diagnose and prescribe for, I think are good investments in healthcare overall. But
to the new consultants contract, he says that despite consultants going in, there has been a fall in the average number of patients per consultant, and quotes, some of it was the hospitals not responding to the greater number of doctors. And he says there simply has not been a productivity culture in the Irish public healthcare system. Not just that, it is not unique to healthcare. It is a public service challenge, and it is largely to do with incentives.
Yeah, and I picked up that line in particular where he said it's not just about the health system, it's the public system. And I actually disagree with that. I think this narrative that private sector is good, public service poor, is wrong, and it's too simple, because certainly many private sector organisations will not provide some of the services that are needed for the public system, and that's why it exists. It would not be profitable to provide some services. That's why we have a public service on health in particular. So I think some of that narrative I would challenge strongly.
But he does give reasoning. He says it isn't just an innate thing to do with public and private. He talks about the nature of the incentives, and he says that if you have hospital income does not rely on the volume of public patient activity, worse than that, there are reverse incentives, because if hospitals are given capped budgets for the year, they may slow down care in the latter half of the year. So they're incentivized if they know, well, we're running short of cash, slow everything down until we get through this budgetary process. That's a real economic incentive.
Yeah, and look, there's certainly the issue of incentivization for provision of healthcare and provision of public healthcare is something that would be a very valuable debate. And certainly comparisons between hospital performances, community centre, primary care centre performance, I think is a good thing. And I think the Minister has brought that forward. But again, some of the pieces I would challenge in all of that is the... if you look at the public health system and you do some comparisons, first of all, we have to understand we have a very ageing and growing population, and it is a lot of very complex care. And you can get differences in areas and communities between, you know, I remember being in one particular hospital where over 70% of the people in beds in hospital were over the age of 70. You know, that's a high complex care. Now, it's not too easy to define simple metrics across all of that care that's need to be provided and comparison between individual patients and individual consultants. But again, there has been good progress in terms of the data that the Minister is talking about, comparing consultants' performance, consultants having performance reviews. I think they're all really good initiatives, but I just would caution some of the simplification of some of those metrics, some of the comparison between private and public. The Minister specifies, he gives three examples of where there's good productivity. He referenced general practice, pharmacy and NTPF. Yes, but they're the very different public health models. You know, so I think.
But his argument in that instance is what he's saying is if you're a GP, you're incentivized economically with throughput. That's what you need. I'll see this patient, I get paid. I see that patient, I get paid. If you're in the public system, the opposite is the case. You get a budget and how many patients you see doesn't matter.
Well, I can only give my experience in visiting many of those hospitals. And I very rarely experienced either consultants or nurses or porters or caterers who just had a view, let's just slow things up. In fact, I experienced quite the opposite. They really had an amazing commitment to seeing patients through, to seeing patient care, to seeing patients being discharged, you know. So I just have a caution on not the article or journalist, but I have a caution on some of those messages. And if you take it a little bit further, I just have a little concern of recent, and it's always referenced in relation to University Hospital Limerick, you know, and the Minister has acknowledged this capacity issue. He also acknowledged, or it's very publicly acknowledged a bit more lately, there's a management issue and there's a consultant issue. Again, I would urge a little bit of caution on that. I think if there's management issues, sort it out in the dressing room and sort it. If there are consultants issues, sort it out. I think it's increasingly being put out there. And I know the management team in UHL. I know the consultants, clinical teams in UHL. I've experienced them nothing other than really committed health professionals. So I just, it doesn't land with me too well when we just start to kind of publicly shame a particular management team.
Well, and not just shame them, accept them from all of the other figures. He's quoted directly as saying, on trolleys, January to May of this year, the total numbers of presentations nationally into emergency department went up 10%, but the total number on trolleys went down 14%. When you take Limerick out, they went down 20%.
Yeah, and look, there are issues about UHL that has to be addressed. I would value hugely the Minister appointed a team in there, which was Grace Rothwell, who was previously General Manager in Waterford, and Fergal Hickey, who's an excellent emergency department. Because they were sent in to do a job, to make recommendations. We should go, we should implement them. But just the continual remarks about the management team, or the consultants, and capacity, in fairness to the Minister, he's referenced a tree. But I maybe call me a traditional leader or a traditional manager. I do that stuff in the dressing room, you know.
Can I ask one question? Craig, you're a political editor with the Mail. You might have a view on this. One of the things that Stephen Donnelly talks about all the time is being midway through a journey. And does there come a point where you say, well, you've been the Minister for Health for 4.5 years. How long do you expect to be Minister for Health for?
Well, I think if you talk to anyone about to take on a big brief like health or housing, I mean, oh no, Brennan Sinn Féin would tell you that it's a 10-year plan. So I think to be able to say you have an idea to solve the health or to solve many of the health issues in the health service within one life span of a government is wishful thinking.
Oh, well, come on. Look, there's one issue that he talks about in this. He says a major shift in productivity would be getting people to work 5 days over seven. In other words, that you work a 5 day week, but two of those days might be a Saturday and Sunday. Surely that is possible within 4 years.
You'd expect so, right? And look, these are the things that he'll have to answer for come the general election. And Fianna Fáil will have to put forward a new policy platform on what they want to achieve. And I guess be judged on what they haven't delivered on. But look, the trolleys will be a key thing. But actually, I want to come back to another thing that's referenced in that Business Post article and another piece they had during the week about Minister Donnelly wanting to link the level of funding to the level of reform implemented in hospitals. And I remember reading it and just thinking, could you imagine if, you know, a hospital in, let's say, Cork hadn't implemented a high level of reform, and then Minister Donnelly would say to his party leader, Micheál Martin, sorry, the hospital in your constituency isn't getting that funding. I think that's a political time bomb waiting to go off, to be honest.
Well, that is literally what he is saying is his ultimate goal. Ursula, he says, if we find that your clinical team, in spite of having been given more resources, isn't treating any more patients, then we're not giving you any more resources until you figure out how to treat more patients.
Yeah, I read over that line a few times when I saw it this morning, and I kind of, sort of was very surprised to see that. So essentially what he's saying is, if you're struggling and if you don't have enough resources and if things aren't going well for you, we're going to double down on that. And like you said, that would be a political bomb waiting to happen. It just would be a very counterproductive, counterintuitive approach to take, saying that, you know, the places that need the most attention and maybe the most kind of investment and the most kind of buoying up, we're going to take the opposite approach because we want to make it your problem, not our problem, even though we're the ones who get to provide the resources.
What I assume the minister will say is, well, it isn't that we will simply ignore you and not give you resources. We will demand from you a strategy to show how you are going to change your performance. Based on that, we will, I mean, the RTE model, we're going to starve you until you show you're improving.
Well, there's that, but that's it. You know, if you're starving them until they do it, then what sort of a strategy they're going to be able to implement if they're being starved throughout that? And that's why I think this kind of idea of a productivity model within the health service is, like Paul was saying, they're kind of a bit of a simplification of what the process is. Because if you have a situation where you're asking doctors to kind of have X amount of patients, or you need them to achieve X amount of results and all the rest of it, that If you're basing it on those kind of metrics, what does that do for the amount of time that they're spending with each patient? And they're talking about a preventative care model, they're talking about holistic approaches to care and all the rest of it. If you are doing it by a head count of numbers of how many people are you seeing each day, how many people are you getting in and out of the door, as if it's just a basic kind of any kind of consumer service, it's not a public health service. And I think that's one of the challenges that maybe isn't really seen in this productivity model.
Paul, you look to be agreeing.
No, and again, in case I say on defence and the kind of productivity issue, it's not. And I think that debate is welcomed in the health service, to have that debate around productivity. You know, value for money, return on investment is quite right. I've spent 30 years in the private sector, although I might be known as a public service official. And the private sector struggles with productivity issues because it's not a simple linear issue. So he's right to have that debate. But I would summarise it by saying, you know, for me, healthcare and improvements in healthcare for future generations in Ireland is a combination of three big issues. Number one, which is policy and the relevant investment to support that policy. Number two, certainly operational performance and process issues and how it happens. And three, which is the reform. And let's not forget, the policy issue in terms of reform of the health service is not just within the hospital system. It's providing a community healthcare system that stops people having to go to the hospital system for their point of care and the emergency department as their point of entry into the health system. So things like integrated care for older persons happening in a primary care centres is the way to go. So I think the debate needs to continuously focus on what are we doing, how do we continuously invest in that reform issue, and the simplification of a productivity issue and singling out of particular hospitals for weak productivity. I think it's an unfortunate point that we've entered.
But do you not ultimately have to get there? I mean, do you not ultimately have to say, if we have an acute system based across a number of centres, they must be comparable with each other, and there must be some kind of metrics where you can hold a manager to account at the end of a year and say, how are you not performing as well as a counterpart across the country?
And there may be, sorry, there are for definite certain metrics that can be comparable. But there are others that aren't. I mean, if you're a hospital system in an area of high social deprivation, it's factually known that the health outcomes for people who live in areas of high social deprivation are much worse. The demands on the health system are going to be worse by comparison with areas of, you know, higher wealth. So that's a factor. So these things need to be considered as well.
Craig, you want to come in?
Yeah, I think if you just go back to the kind of carrot and stick approach there, and the minister had the press conference during the week with him, and he was asked by UHL, and he was saying that, you know, on, you know, discharges and dry numbers, where hospitals had implemented reforms that he and the HC wanted, numbers were coming down, and in places where they hadn't, the numbers were going up or remaining static. But I think a colleague of mine made the point, and this is the real challenge, and it's interesting to hear Paul's view on this, is when you're constantly firefighting, you know, and when you're in a situation where you really are strained and every day is a real challenge, how do you get that bit of breathing space to implement any reforms? And I think that's the key challenge that they're facing in UHL, I think.
I suspect this is the thing that anybody listening will come to, Paul, is that you look back 30, 40 years and we have the same dialogue constantly going on, whether it's back to Cowan and the Department of Health being Angola. For decades, we've had this thing of how do you actually get better efficiency and better productivity in the health system? And I suspect a lot of people think it's just the reality.
But let's also remind ourselves, we in Ireland have some of the best health outcomes. People are living longer. People are living longer, healthier lives. In terms of, if you have any of the kind of big issues in terms of healthcare, so cardio issues, heart issues, if you have oncology, cancer issues, or if you have respiratory issues, three of the biggest killers in health issues, where you want to be is in the public system. We have great outcomes in terms of in health in Ireland. Yes, there's big challenges, but let's remind ourselves we've really good outcomes for people in health in Ireland.
53106 will cost a 30 cent if you want to get in touch, or you can get us on WhatsApp 087 1400 106. Michael O'Leary is giving out again. He's giving out about Fingal. He's giving out about Eamon Ryan. He's giving out a little bit about Boeing, but he's optimistic about potential improvements in their performance. We'll discuss that after this break. And as I said, Michael O'Leary is giving out, as he has been quite a bit this week, he's giving out about the passenger cap in Dublin Airport. You will have heard him saying that it is his expectation that by Christmas we could see a cost of, what, 500 or 1,000, depending on which interview he said it in, to fly to London. He is describing the passenger cap in Dublin Airport as a complete shambles. And he's telling Ellie Donnelly in the Business Post that we have been calling for 2 years on Transport Minister Eamon Ryan to scrap this stupid 2007 traffic cap. Sadly, he has failed to act, preferring to hide behind the planning process. This restriction was designed to address fears that road access to and from the airport would not be able to facilitate traffic. It is clear that this concern is no longer valid. He's fairly doubling down on his opposition to the passenger cap, isn't he?
He is, but I mean, at the same time, it's met with the same response every time. We don't have political influence in the planning system for very good reasons that I don't need to go over now. I think that everyone will be aware of. It's a good thing we don't have political influence in the planning system. Now, what I would say is I haven't seen much in the way of workarounds coming back in terms of trying to find other solutions around it. But I don't know why Michael Leary keeps asking for the same thing when he knows the minister can't intervene.
Well, I assume he believes that if you make enough noise and if you apply enough pressure, whether or not there is direct political interference or intervention in the planning process, it certainly sets a tone in which the planning decision has to get made.
Yeah, well, the other thing I will say about Michael Leary, apart from being an excellent businessman, he's great at making the news headlines. And I think the prospect of people worrying about their children getting home for Christmas and having to pay exorbitant flights certainly will focus the minds of some of the electorate who the government will have to face, you know, in the coming months. So, you know, hat tip to him there as well.
Yeah, he says Dublin Airport is already running over the 32 million passenger cap, and now we are running up against real capacity issues this Christmas and now next summer because nobody will deal with the issue. And Ellie Donnelly's piece quotes him as having said that we are looking at potentially up to €500 one way from London to the capital as a result of the cap. Do you believe that, Ursula?
I think it's just like Craig's after saying there, it's a very good way to hit the headlines, and it's a very good way to make a bit of a fuss and to make sure that we're all talking about it, which obviously is his goal. That is his aim. Absolutely it is. And he's very, very good at making sure he gets onto the front page or into the papers and into the public discourse, because it is something that, you know, people will react to, absolutely. But whether or not he would actually follow through with that or whether or not it's going to reach that stage remains to be seen. But, who knows how it's going to go. He raises the point about maybe the length of time that it's taken to make decisions and about kind of like the slowness of the process. Like, that is valid, but at the same time, if he's gone after Eamon Ryan in a very personal capacity a lot in recent weeks and months, and whether or not that's the best way to really push the issues that you have, I really don't know. I don't know how much it really does for public discourse. Really, it gets very personal, especially when you announce.
But this has been Michael O'Leary's MO for years. I mean, he did the same with Mary O'Rourke back in the day.
He did the same, and I suppose it's his MO, and he's done very well out of it, and he knows what he's about. But whether or not, if every CEO, if every company spent their time on the airwaves really going after people in a really personal capacity like this, I don't know how nice it would be to turn on the radio and actually listen to what's going on all the time. But such as it is, it's whether or not it actually brings up, €500 flights come Christmas time, I think he would even get a bit of backlash. I think even he would get a bit of backlash for that come Christmas time.
Well, Paul Reid, you happen to be centrally involved to some extent in this one as well, in that you were previously the, not county manager, what was your official title in Fingal?
CEO of Fingal County Council.
Which, of course, isn't the planning body in respect of the airport. This is a board Planola issue, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm never sure whether I follow crisis or crisis follows me, but that was my role there. Yeah, now these are two on board Planola planning conditions that were put on. Actually, one of the two conditions was related to the flight times in terms of the building of the new runway. You get a certain amount of flights between certain times and nighttime restriction flights. And then the second one was the 32 million cap, as you mentioned there. And it was for the reasons Michael Leary spoke about accessibility and traffic that would involve getting to the airport, etc. And certainly that was 2007. So some points he might make are right. We have moved on. We have a national infrastructure and roadway that's much better than it was then. So,
And if I remember the political context, 2006 and 2007, it's hard to cast your mind back, but the commute was a major political issue at the time. One of the things was people stuck in cars for 2 hours back and forth, and therefore you could see in that context that made sense. It's not quite as bad now.
No, it's not. But it's not easy either. I mean, some of the M50 infrastructure that's there, you can see. So, but go back to the fundamental point. It was a board Planola issue. How it can be looked at, I'm not too sure. I think we do have to respect the planning process, and we've all got in politically, we got in awful roles before where there was interference in that. But I think the planning process has to respect. But equally, you would like to think there might be a way of navigating through this. I think Michael Leary's timing of it is obviously political election potentially coming up, making the point, putting the pressure on. But there's two good pieces. There's in the Sunday Business Post, there's Matt Cooper's piece as well, as Ellie Donnelly's, and Matt speaks about, I guess, the modus operandi of Michael Leary as a CEO. And you'd have to respect a lot of it. I had some professional dealings with Michael in my time in Fingal, and I have to say they were always really professional experiences in the true sense of dealing with them. An interesting one morning heading to work, their headquarters is in Swords, right at a big roundabout in the industrial station. I was driving into work and saw a big, huge drape over the building, and it's Europe's busiest airline or something. And I thought it was quite nice, but I was only in the office about an hour, and one of the planners said to me, "That's a planning issue. They can't have that. It's a traffic risk. It's a risk and everything." So I had to, I had a draft letter in front of me. I said, "I better give Michael a ring first," So I rang the office, and straight away he took my call, and as professional as he was, said, "Okay, get your point. We'll have it down."
Really?
Absolutely. And fully compliant and fully professional there in terms of how he dealt with it. So, and I had one or two other experiences with him, and I have to say, very professional in terms of how he dealt with us as a county council. Yeah.
It's funny, there is a piece in there as well about his salary, and it's juxtaposed with only a couple of pages on in the same paper, a layout of top executive pay in Ireland. And if you want to really make the big money, you need to get into cement, because CRH's CEO is making 12 million to run CRH. Glanbia's CEO is making 7.9 million. Icon CEO is making 6.6 million. And in the piece, Michael O'Leary says, "Am I concerned about my bonus? Not particularly, but I do think the fact that I haven't made the bonus now for 6 years shows just how stretching the targets are. But when I see what they're voting on in Tesla today for Elon Musk, Kylian Mbappe getting a sign-on fee for 85 million just to go play football at Real Madrid, I think I'm much undervalued and underappreciated. Do we feel sorry for him struggling by on the clippings of tin on, what is it, 4.44 million?
Oh, it's shocking he can make ends meet, isn't it? He's awful brave.
Sorry, I undercut him. He's 4.68 million.
Oh, well then, he's well comfortable. He'll be fine then. But
he'd be good outside left for Real Madrid, in fairness.
One final thing before we wrap up, which is a story from, I think this is inside the Sunday Independent. I don't know if you saw this, Craig. This is the story of how the study of slightly depressed fish may help with understanding human depression, and that you can tell if a fish is depressed.
That's right. Scientist down in University College Cork is taking on this analysis because he said there are some genetic similarities between the zebrafish and humans. The key thing to look for in your zebrafish, if it's depressed, if it's swimming low, it's likely to be depressed. If it's swimming up high or in amongst the plants, then it's a happy zebrafish.
So. How do they know? Like, how do you know that the fish, if it's swimming at the bottom, is less happy than the fish swimming at a higher level?
I feel really guilty because when our kids were small, we did the usual, got a goldfish tanking, but I can only remember them ever swimming at the bottom. I'm not sure what we did wrong.
But the logic of this is that there is, because the genetic similarities between the zebrafish and humans, they can use it as a good test bed for, is it for pharmaceutical intervention, is that the idea?
Yeah, so I have to bow to my colleagues down at University College Cork on the finer detail of this one, Anton.
I give you the tough ones. Guys, thank you very much for your time this morning. That is Paul Reid, who is Chair of the Citizens' Assembly on Drug Use and former Chief Executive of the HSE. Craig Hughes, Political Editor with the Irish Daily Mail. And Ursula Savage, Political Commentator.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.